In Jane Dolan's novel Leash, it is suggested that when it comes to our sexuality, nothing is quite as freeing as having no choice. It is a surreal story about a gay Manhattan writer exploring her sexual limits and discovering that giving up control forces her and the reader to look at the fine line between disgust and desire. And this is where Jane's skill as a writer is so evident, where we see women that struggle with the urge to both be sexually free and sexually secure, to both discover and reinvent themselves, to be true to their sexuality and also escape it. This is what Jane's work does best, examines our sexuality and our hang-ups with honesty and often surprising humor. In her novel Enthrall, set in the 1960s, she looks again at the relationship between women, particularly between a 16-year-old girl and her 37-year-old English teacher, and the secrecy of their relationship. In Don Juan in the Village, her book of 14 stories of lesbian relationships takes one complex, unnamed character, a woman who is bold, mocking, lonely, sarcastic, but never indifferent to us, through the bars in cities such as Los Angeles, Morocco, Puerto Rico, and New York City. Of this book, Bret Easton Ellis wrote that, quote, "The writing is so finely crafted, even though the only thing seemingly linking these episodes of sexual conquest and submission is the narrator's coldly urgent voice, a palatable and troubling suspense builds, and something frightening happens. We recognize ourselves, whether we want to or not, on just about every page." Jane Dolan is the author of the novels Leash, Don Juan in the Village, Real Estate, Enthrall, and Some Do, and edited the anthology New York Sex. Her work has appeared in the Paris Review, Mademoiselle, Glamour, Harper's Bazaar, the New York Times, and the New York Observer, among many others. During the Gulf War, she lived and worked in Saudi Arabia as a correspondent for Mirabella and Rolling Stone, and her works have been translated into several languages, including German, French, Japanese, and Spanish. She currently teaches art in the graduate program of the Sam Fox School of Design and Visual Arts here at Washington University. Please give a warm welcome to Jane Dolan.
Actually, I teach writing at the Sam Fox School of the Art, and unfortunately, I can't live up to that introduction. At my age, there's nothing new to learn about sex, so I've had to go on to other subjects. I'll be reading from The Pool. It's either a heartwarming story about tragedy and redemption or a horror story. I'm not sure which. Okay, this section is set on July 4th. When the sun is hot, when the white is in your eyes, when behind the eyelids it's white instead of orange, when the salt of your sweat burns your eyes, when the hairs at the back of your head are soaking, when the sky is white with heat, when the wind stops blowing, when beach grasses are still, when drops of water coalesce on the outside of your glass, when the ice melts so quickly you can see the paler areas in the coke, when children won't leave the air-conditioned den, when the dog hides under the house, when people drink lemonade instead of beer, when eyelashes flutter over the page, when sentences dissolve into patterns, when dirt sticks to the layer of sweat all over your body, when sunblock melts in your eyes, when the pool water seems too warm, when you're too tired to get out of the sun, when you can see grass wobble in the heat, when transparent bubbles float in front of your eyes, when all is silent save the humming of insects, when the glider drifts overhead, when you lie flat on the lawn to study the insects and the grass seems as high as a cornstalk, when the heat is as powerful as heroin, when it's exercise just to breathe, when you're glad from the distant music from the other house, when talking is too much effort, when it's impossible to get up to go to the bathroom, when the lawn chair is wet with your sweat, when you jump in the pool to cool off and you dry before you sit down, when the air is so hot you develop a chill, when you're not sure if you're asleep or not, when you talk out loud in your dreams, when with your eyes shut you can't remember whether you're floating on the raft or thinking of this in your chair, when the world in your head meets the head in your world, when desire is more than enough, when the sun gets white, when the sun gets clouds, when the cook won't grill, when the dog won't come when you yell, when the cat reclines in the tub, when the newspaper goes unread, when the insects stop humming, when the shirt is unbuttoned, when sunglasses don't work, when the neighbor doesn't matter, when plants are wilting, when the phone goes unanswered, when baseball's in the background, when the water's too hot, when the bikini loses its top, when the wind chimes are silent, when the bumblebee sits in your foot, when the sandal is no longer worn, when the straps slip off your shoulders, when the presents cannot be opened, when the sweat is filled with perfume, when dirt feels good in your toes, when the mother-in-law is okay, when the Nova goes uneaten, when the sun pushes on your closed eyelids like the pressure of water against the body while scuba diving, when pressure outside eliminates the pressure within, when the brain is utterly calm, when the synapses stop clicking. That's my kind of day. Meditation can do this, and drugs, but meditation is work and you need patience. And if patience is what you need in the first place, that's a problem. And drugs can do it, but they're not cool anymore somehow, at least for the people I know. But the sun is okay, it's cool, it's free. It's why people in the tropics are happy. They come north looking for money, planning to go back when the kids grow up. But the kids grow up and marry and get jobs, and before you know it, they're grandchildren, so they end up staying. Myself, I'd stay put down there with the shiny green plants and year-round sun and the waves, humidity relaxing my muscles so I'd want to have sex, even with someone I don't like. But what's not to like about someone with smooth, dark skin and a soft accent and a desire for pleasure that has nothing to do with being able to spend $500 on a bottle of wine? White people don't know how to have fun. They have to spend money and hop on planes to have fun. Fun for them is the equivalent of work. Brian's garden is not lush. Lush is vulgar somehow, and we have taste. This is in the Hamptons. White people have taste. Within the boundaries of taste, the garden passes muster. The appropriate mix of seagrasses, perennials, costly and unusual varieties of roses and hydrangeas, clematis working its way up the fence, papyrus, the latest thing, in a tiny man-made pond, the long row of perfectly trimmed hedges, and most of all, a huge slab of velvety green grass. It's an irony, I suppose, that these visually perfect and cool-evoking slabs of green cannot be sat in during the heat of the day, and hence are more looked at than experienced. A tableau seen from the air-conditioned safety of the house, whereas gardens in otherwise hotter climates with their overgrown vines and trees and endless colorful flowers are, in fact, due to the intensity of the vegetation and the shade they provide, much more comfortable to sit in. Of course, what else could one do in the days before air conditioning? Even now, the poor somehow manage to survive without it. Lawns out here, however, derive from the English tradition. Huge parks landscape for the point of view from the manor house, the walker in a cool and damp climate. But it's hot here in the summer, and these houses are primarily lived in during the summer. If we sit outside then, it must be under an awning or umbrella or a pergola, or an arbor protected by clematis, or climbing roses, or grape leaves. Since my eyes are closed, I smell rather than see the grasses around me, which means there must be watering, and I can hear the dog breathing and smell his fur when he plops in the pool. Ugh, someone says, but Brian allows Generalissimo in the pool. It's a wasp, we're good to our animals kind of thing. People are talking about the movie we saw last night. Almost everyone considers it pretentious, so the argument is about whether it was merely pretentious or whether the pretentiousness was there in order to get to something that could not have been gotten to, at least by this particular director, in some other way. Then someone asks if it isn't pretentious to act as if anything that had a style was pretentious, and I realize a second after I heard the words that they were spoken by me. Then we are on to the difference between style and stylization, the former presumably being good and the latter the decadent extension of it into what, if carried to a logical conclusion, might be kitsch. And then we argue whether Geary has become stylized in a parody of himself, for in a way nothing is more formulaic or stylized than a computer program. You might say it almost has its own inherent style. But then Philip walks over and explains to us in a relatively clear way what CAD, C-A-D, the program, the architectural program, really is, and we drop that idea. Roberta says what's important is not whether something is stylized or not, but the purpose of the stylization, whether it's in the service of some idea or merely to call attention to itself, which is no longer an interesting thing to do. But Mark and Carlos vehemently disagree with her on the grounds that, tautologically speaking, there is nothing that does not have style. Roberta declares that if everything has style, then the word loses its meaning, and we are left only with stylish or stylized, adjectives which imply a kind of decadence, and that if we were to take what they're saying to its logical conclusion, Duchamp may as well have put a paperclip in the museum. Indeed, says Carlos, paperclips are very beautiful and have their own meanings. Mark tries to bridge these positions by saying that things have a style if one says they do, hence Duchamp choosing the urinal to be placed in a museum. But Roberta again argues that this pseudo-democratization would result in the destruction of the very notion of art. Carlos, of course, likes that idea, and Sissa Roberta doesn't only because she's a curator and, by virtue of cognitive dissonance, has adopted beliefs that, say, had she remained in academia, she would not have. The argument is now extended to the natural world. A urinal is made by a human, or a factory designed by a human, whether style consciously came into the matter or not. But what about an orchid? If Duchamp had put an orchid in that museum, it would not have made the same point as a urinal, if only because putting flowers in vases is what people do every day in their houses. Surely that's not art. But it's interesting you chose orchids, says Alex, who I thought was sleeping, because in a way they're the most stylized of plants. But how can a plant that no one designed be stylized, asks Carlos. Who's the stylizer? God, of course, laughs Alex. But to be serious, no one can deny that orchids are stylized in a way that oak trees, for instance, are not. Mark begs to differ, for it seems to kind of go against the democratic and non-hierarchical notion of art, but the argument sort of sputters out until someone, me again, says that it's really about morality. Style has morality where stylization does not. Stylization is what a movement degenerates into when the purpose has gone out of it and it just becomes a kind of convention, say, at the end of abstract expressionism. Are you saying that Joan Mitchell started with style and ended with stylization, someone asked? Your notion seems to imply that personal style will always degrade. Some woman whose name I forget thinks we're talking about Joni Mitchell and says Joni Mitchell is style, whereas Judy Collins is stylization. Or perhaps it was vice versa. And then Claudia, who's into pita and a bit of a bore, brings up Damien Hirst. My statement about morality has evidently encouraged her. She's just a buyer for Bloomingdale's and therefore prone to a slight inferiority in talking about matters of art, to encourage her to bring up the decadence of contemporary art. But that's what they said about the Impressionists or even Monet, says Carlos. In fact, when Constable painted grass green, everyone was appalled because the grass and paintings had become ground with the glaze and underpainting emerging over time. And it took Constable to make people realize that the color of grass, and you must remember this is England where grass is green, was green. But Claudia argues it's different. How can you cut up an animal and call it art? To extend Carlos's argument to the limit, why not just put a sign in a butcher shop and call the whole thing a museum? Because, Claudia dear, these are very thin strips of a cow, precisely cut, encased in plastic. If it's the beauty of the object and not the idea, why not just replicate the whole cow in plastic? Because it wouldn't look as good. No. You mean the idea wouldn't be as powerful. People like it because it violates a norm about how we should treat animals. Next, we'll be putting slices of dead people in museums. I suppose you'll think that's okay, as long as it's not your body that's being cut up. Thank God Brian arrives with drinks. Carlos takes his glasses off and gets in one of those floats that have glass holders in it and pushes off the side of the pool. Claudia, though hot, won't get in the pool since the dog's been in it, despite her love of animals. Then squeals of disgust because Robin is doing something disgusting. Robin is always doing something disgusting, and people are always pretending to be disgusted and shocked by the disgusting things he does. But really, this is why people have Robin around, to see him do something disgusting that can titillate them and give them something to talk about. Robin does things like chew with his mouth open on your Persian rug, so that little driblets of food fall onto it, or he'll vomit in a vase and not tell anybody, or pee in the orchid someone invented specially for you. He'll try to seduce the new young thing one of his friends or fellow house guests really likes, and of course he never pays for anything. I guess you can call him amusing if you like that sort of thing. This time what he did was, by Robin's standards, not so terrible. After Brian's dog Generalissimo peed on the grass, Robin rolled over in a chaise, stuck his dick through the hole in his bathing suit, and recycled to the universe some of the beer he'd been drinking. The smell lasted for a few seconds, then it went away, or we got used to it, and in a few minutes the ground wasn't even wet. "What's the big deal?" he asked. "Such a long way to the house." Groans, but the kind we enjoy making. If I had a dick, I can pee on the grass too. But I think, not having a dick, my peeing on the grass would not be greeted with the same mixture of amusements that Robin's was. And on it goes, sleeping and walking and occasionally staggering to the pool, and I'm already half drunk by 7:30 when the guests start to arrive. The party. Some come in little black or white dresses with heels, guys in khaki shorts or seersucker pants, but many are, as the invite suggested, in costume, things that look like muumuus, dresses that were bought in the Greek islands, blaring shirts from Bali, sarongs that twist around the waist, blouses unbuttoned over bikini tops. The year of the male skirt never really happened, but here is Robin wearing one anyway, salvaged from way back in the closet. It's still hot and everyone is still complaining about the heat, but they're happy complaining about it. Even the rich enjoy on occasion being subjected to something beyond their control, an excuse to unbutton shirts and display abs or bikini tops, as long as this lack of control is temporary, as long as it's fun. The bartender is handsome and cool, jacquard pattern black shirt, white shorts, black rubber sandals with huge swirling ridges on the bottom. He's thin but faintly muscled, with no body or facial hair, but on top it's long and sleek, slick-backed. No doubt he'll be more successful than any of us. He's got a grant from AFI to make a movie, well, a short, but he's doing a full length of digital tape instead, editing on the computer and then transferring to film later. Many people do the opposite. He can't figure out why. He's only 26, but before this he was a designer, an airline steward, and a horse trainer, if I understand the Aussie accent correctly. Both men and women eye him. The women also eye the men eyeing him. Two girls are working the kitchen. Two more bring us food. They are astonishingly thin and beautiful, or maybe it just looks that way to our older eyes. They're sweet, too, with the ironic valley intonation they sometimes slip into, but they listen seriously when they talk, when you talk, nodding their heads as if they follow, their minds on the food, the tips, the party they'll meet their boyfriends at later. I try to flirt with the Haitian with the soft, sweet voice who stands behind a table with a huge trash can of ice and oysters and a knife that he uses very adeptly. Some people are discussing the stock market, which has started down again after going up, after going down. But what if the housing market falls as well? Maybe we should all sell our houses and buy ones back later when the bubble breaks. But interest rates are still low, which is precisely why they're bound to rise. Eventually, the deficit and the trade imbalance will cause a rise in interest rates, which will kill the housing market, which will mean no business at all will be driving the economy. Then I guess it'll be time to start another war. Robin is taking the whole shrimp and throwing the peels on the ground. He talks as he eats so you can see the pink and white inside his mouth. He has a brilliant idea. If the towelheads hate us, let's just leave. They don't want our money? Fine, we won't buy their oil. We'll get it from Mexico, Venezuela, even those dickheads in Texas. So what if it costs more? We'll keep it in the hemisphere. Take away their excuse for hating us. Think what we'd save on the military. But of course, the stupid fucks will hate us anyway, because once we stop buying their oil for our cars, they'll probably all starve to death. Good riddance. It's not like any of them have ever done a thing in their lives except ride camels on land that wouldn't have been worth a dime if we, whom they hate, hadn't invented cars. Liberal gasps. I've had similar thoughts myself, so I should defend Robin, but I don't. As if apropos, someone mentions he's reading A Short Walk in the Hindu Kush. But that's not oil country, that's Afghanistan, someone says. No, it's... The UGA guy brings up Israel. Stephen, meanwhile, is boasting to Jack about the young guy he's seeing, 24, Hispanic, not intellectual exactly, but really very intelligent. Stephen has given him 100 years of solitude, and he really likes it. Elizabeth talks how much better her son feels now that he's switched from Ritalin to, oh, you know that new ADHD drug, what's it called? Adderall. But there's no such thing as ADHD, my dear, says Robin, or ADD for that matter. just natural high spirits that would be celebrated in another era. Surely you don't think humans were made for multitasking. Come live with him, just one day, Elizabeth responds. My dear, I thought you'd never ask. Someone asks how come golfers don't wear earrings or have pierced ears like baseball or basketball players. Because they're white, duh. Which sets Bernard, who works for the Nature Conservancy, off. We have all heard a million times how grass is really nothing more than a giant boondoggle for the petrochemical industry. Prairie grass is neater and cheaper. Lawn is fine for England where it's wet and cold, but environmentally inexcusable here, and even more so in the Southwest. It's not manifest destiny that developed the Southwest, he insists, but fertilizer companies. Don't get him started on cotton. His summer shirts and shorts are from that cute little place in Soho, Only Hemp. In a pinch, you can smoke them too, ha ha ha. In addition to the oyster bar, there's a wonderful mango salsa, guacamole, of course, poached salmon, itsy-bitsy grilled lamb chops. Slightly overcooked, but wonderful anyway, at least until you think of the baby lambs. Don't. I've gone from margaritas to beer to seltzer and back again. Way off to one side of my mind is the storm cloud of an approaching headache, but like when rain is coming, you try to stay in the sun as long as you can. So I literally look the other way or even avoid taking an Advil, because that will make my headache official. I should lie down, but I'd never get up. I could join the kids who are watching DVDs, but I hear arguments as I'm walking across the grass and stop, sit down in it, wiggle my toes. Despite the heat, there's dew even now, which makes the sarong I flung over my tankini unpleasantly stick to my body. Although I'm warm, sweaty even, a chill goes through me, and suddenly I'm cold, warm but cold, as if I were sick. It's not real karaoke. You gotta sing, but anyone can grab the mic. Mr. Electronic Keyboards can play anything. Because it's drunk in July 4th and it's been a kind of so-so year, Brian told him to go back into time, into kind of a drug haze in high school, I Will Survive and Dancing in the Dark, and a surprisingly effective falsetto version of Heart of Glass from Dawn's Brother. It should be funny, but it's sad. You can see people looking off to the right and through you, as they do when their minds travel back in time. People who are dead or alive, and people who are gone or back. I'm on the roof of a building in Miami Beach in a bright white suit. A disc jockey I'm dating is doing unspeakable things to me in the middle of the night, things I can't get even done in private anymore. But who's to witness but the old folks on the top floor of the retirement hotel across the street? Jack imitates Brian Ferry singing these foolish things, but nobody gets it but me, because I know from way back he's a Brian Ferry freak. Everyone else thinks he's just a drunk who's trying to enunciate over precisely. And Brian, our spickle spackle host in white seersucker shirt and striped white and blue seersucker shorts, is singing, I Won't Dance, Don't Ask Me, in a falsetto reminiscent of the tall waiter at Marie's Crisis. And as he sings, he's also dancing. His partner, a big round plate of hors d'oeuvres, he holds admirably upright on his left arm, even as he twirls it around, even as he bends over and holds it low to the ground, as if he'd bust for rich kids at summer camp. It's the pre-Philip Brian, nights we stayed awake till dawn and beyond, and I'm glad to see he still exists, even if it requires the ingestion of a startling amount of alcohol to awaken him from his hibernation. Then Brian slips. He's wearing loafers with leather, not rubber bottoms. Perhaps he dipped his porcelain partner a little too far, and stuff on the plate starts sliding off into the pool. Prosciutto-wrapped figs, a cilantro-flavored dip, and a big bowl of olives. Hungry, Brian asks, and when I shake my head, he says, sure you are. And in his face, I see what's coming and start moving backward. But it's hard because Brian's Bouvier de Flandre is there, and I don't want to trip and drop my glass. And to this day, I can't figure out whether it was my slipping on the wet stone near the pool that Philip insisted on over my recommendation of cedar, or Brian's mild push that propels me into the water. Maybe I could have stopped if I'd really tried, but I was worried about the torque on my knee, which is already missing 1.5 ligaments skiing. And perhaps I was not averse also to proving I was right about not using the expensive Italian stone. I land in the water with a big splash which shakes my insides, but my annoyance changes when Brian pushes Philip in the pool after me. Characteristically, even though taken unawares, he'd managed to enter the water with his usual elegance, somehow twisting into a low dive with very little splash. And suddenly it's not a humiliating but the cool place to be. And then it's Jack's turn. He hates to be left out. So instead of scrambling out, I decide to pretend that a dip on the water on this hot and sultry night is what I wanted all along. And in a way it is. But my sarong starts dragging me down. I'm panicked that I'm going to drown and wave to someone for help, but they think I'm being friendly and wave back. It's too embarrassing to call for help in a pool. I dive under and manage with some difficulty to extricate my legs from the sarong, then drag it, heavy with water, to the side of the pool, where it's more difficult than you'd think to get it off me and push it over the side. Then I go back in the middle of the pool where I do the dead man's float under the night sky, arms crossed under my head, very pleasant with the music and the stars, breathing through the top quarter of my lungs so I don't sink, trying to assure myself that for my age I have not such a bad body. And as soon as I think this, I think down, as if to unconsciously hide my stomach, which is my weak point, and so as not to look like I can't float, I purposely dive under. The wavering diamonds in the water from the pool, bewitching and hypnotic. I look where the headache was, but now it's far away or even gone. But this thought slightly brings it back, so I turn my head to the other side, and it occurs to me that with the margarita and beer in the joint, or maybe even X I hope to take later with the Jamaican, I'm happy. The world is good. It's only because I'm Brian's oldest friend that he pushed me into the pool first. We're all good people, and I love everybody, even Philip. Philip lost his glasses, Brian shouts as I come up, and I recall that Philip was wearing, in addition to his Comme des Garçons shirt with a kind of homeboy soft-spun shorts, the $650 neo-nerd square black frame glasses requisite for all architects. Though Brian swore it was because the contacts were giving him dry eye. Philip does seem lost without his glasses. He glances around with the blank face of a nearsighted boy, bravely searching for his mother. So I hyperventilate and dive down, both to look like a nice person and maybe even be a hero. And as I do, I kind of bump against Jack, who's still doing this amusing dead man's float. And somewhere in the back of my brain, there's the thought that he's been doing it an awfully long time. But I push it out of my mind the way you do people in the streets scavenging in trash bins or teenagers in Liberia having their arms chopped off as I search for Philip's glasses. The mind can only handle so many things at once. I grab something in the water, but it's only an olive, and not knowing what to do with it, I eat it. Then Robin, to get the pool part of the party really going, announces some super special prize for whoever finds the most olives, thus giving some of the younger, really buff guys an excuse to strip to their undies, or even nothing at all. No doubt that's why Robin suggested this. Duh. The timing sucks, my having already eaten one olive, but being competitive, I dive down a few more times. But I keep bumping into bodies, so I give up and grab onto the side of the pool. The water seems warmer than the air now, and I grab a towel. It's damp, but better than nothing. At first, Jack thinks it's funny. He's planning a joke about how he's not as drunk as it seems, that just because he kept his hand tight around the vodka and tonic as he fell did not mean he was a dedicated alcoholic. He can hear Robin making the joke. He can imagine parties in the future. Do you remember the time that Jack held onto his glass even when he fell into the pool? I guess he really needed a drink. That's how he discovered the new drink, chlorine and tonic. Some people like lime, some people like chlorine. It's always these moments, these little mistakes, the time the picnic is rained out or the car runs out of gas, that we look back to as fun. So Jack's planning his joke about the vodka and trying to hold his glass steady in the air to impress everyone. And he gives them a big smile, and then there's this funny feeling as his head hits the water. He hears a cracking sound and imagines it's the glass. But no, the glass is still in his hand, though the water in the pool is mingling with the vodka and soda, and he's still going downwards, but somehow he's unable to turn himself or even let go of the glass, and then there's a kind of bump, not very strong, on the bottom, and it hurts a little bit, but not very much, and he reaches out an arm to push himself up, but he can't do it. It's like in a dream where you're trying to do something but can't, and only later do you realize how odd this is, because after all, it's you who makes up your dreams. His arm isn't moving, he's stunned, but he bounces off the bottom and moves upward, watching the way wavy diamond patterns made by the lights at the bottom of the pool recede ever so slowly. Then someone bumps into his head, so his head is angled upward, and he can see people holding drinks by the side of the pool. They're swirling a bit and magnified by the water. Rainbow halos seem to be around their heads as they stare down at him, more beautiful than ever, and somehow very far away. Beyond them, tables, trees, the house. He's trying to remember if in all those paintings David Hockney did of pools, there's one from this angle, looking up at night through water to the above water world, and if not, why not? He's rising to them slowly, as if he's floating on air through the sky, like in that Bill Viola video, and he's so much part of everything, he feels nothing. Some bubbles rise from his mouth, and does he imagine, or can he actually see reflected in the people in bright colors around the side of the pool? Then he sees a floating penis right by his head. He thinks of putting it in his mouth. Now that would be a story for Robin. Then he's bumped again, or maybe it's just the side of the pool and he's floating face down now. And though he's still interested in the wavy diamonds in the bottom of the pool, he needs to breathe. And to do this, he needs to turn over. But though he tries to twist his body, he can't. What is there to twist against in the water? How did he ever do it? Meanwhile, the carbon dioxide is triggering the inhale mechanism in his lungs, which he tries but can't totally resist. And if this keeps up and no one comes to his rescue, he'll drown. It's ironic and poignant as well as being very, very sad, because after all, there's oxygen in the water. No need to drown if oxygen's in the water, but it's locked up with the hydrogen, and somehow we're unable to use it, even though we once were fish, or at least globs that lived in the water. And of course, the fish and globs and lobster and octopi and all other floating things that live in the ocean are all able to get their oxygen from water. The whales and dolphins can't. Fuck mammals. A jellyfish could do this, a nudibranch, a coral colony. Surely humans are more important than jellyfish. If ontogeny really recapitulates phylogeny, there should be some residual bills inside his body, anachronistic for the most part, but unexpectedly useful now. The penis floats by again, small, of course, because it shriveled in the water, but a penis all the same. Who doesn't like a penis? If only he were a fish and could live down here sucking penises, what a life. But now that you mention it, he needs to breathe. He really needs to breathe. No joke now. Everything's moving so slowly. He's on the surface. He needs to lift his head. He needs to push it up. But something's holding him down. Funny haha, but he really needs to breathe. Is he drunk or is he dead? Brian, Robin, he needs to breathe so he can make a joke and finish his drink and be teased by Robin and maybe figure out who in the pool that naked penis he saw belonged to. It was like that poem about the Bruegel painting about Icarus, where something tragic is happening, but you're just standing there watching something else. So I was focused on the olives and the contest about the olives because I look forward to making jokes about the winning of the olive contest, and also because I'm so competitive that even the stupidest games arouse my interest. And though I noticed Jack was acting a bit peculiar, and usually it's not Jack but Robin who acts in a peculiar way, I kind of conflated them, as if because Robin was here, Jack was trying to show him up. Not so much show him up as to show that he could do Robin as well as Robin could do Robin. But I think there might have been something else in there, the briefest kind of thought shot through my brain. And I've always been very curious about the minimal length of even the shortest thought and whether this would be measured in fractions of a second or the firing of electrons, as if with 1/n less second or 1 less electron firing, the thought wouldn't register at all. And the content of this thought was something like, maybe something's really wrong with Jack. But I pushed it out of my brain as I push out hundreds of thoughts I have daily out of my brain before they take shape fully. Thoughts about blood clots and embolisms and arterial blockages and strange adhesions and poisonous parasites and reckless cell growth and bombs exploding or trucks losing their brake or pieces of airplanes or missiles falling out of the sky into my head. And not just these thoughts, but humiliating situations I got myself into and stupid things I said, plus regrets and recriminations for what I've done or said or left unsaid or undone about lovers and friends and families and even pets, all the ways I fucked up my career and relationships, different cities I could have moved to and didn't, houses, apartments I should have bought but didn't, stocks I bought but shouldn't have, or stocks I should have bought but didn't. The children I could have had but didn't, about phone calls never returned and letters never sent and email lost in the spam, and all this from as far back as I have memory. Pleasant memories, too, that haunt me because those times are gone, and each and every second these thoughts are waiting to crowd in on one. The more one tries to calm oneself by emptying the mind of thought, the more space there is for thoughts to rush in. The mind is like Holland with dikes ready to burst at any moment. Constant vigilance is required. One error is all it takes. And this is exhausting. It's why the skin gets wrinkles and muscles get tired and cells forget precisely what they're supposed to be doing. Such effort it takes just to keep the horrors at bay so one can walk around the street like others seem to, insouciantly, normally. But for all we know, they're just like us. The insouciance is part of the acting, just part of the effort. And so one of the hundreds or thousands of thoughts I had that day that I pushed out of my mind involved Jack, how he was floating there very peculiarly in the water. But there were other thoughts even then about Jack as well, how in a passive-aggressive way he liked to be the center of attention, how all day he seemed to be out robining Robin, that after all it was his fault for drinking so much, and so on. And then, because being in certain places, geographically beautiful, remote, or very expensive places that are populated with fashionable people, one can make one feel that one's in a movie instead of ordinary life. And this is augmented in this house by torches and colored lanterns creating unnatural highlights and shadows, not to mention the crowds of beautiful of aging 30 and 40 and 50-somethings being served by beautiful, if temporarily economically challenged, teens and 20-somethings, a cast of deluxe extras and lighting effects. So all of this seems not quite real, and if it's not quite real, nothing bad can be happening, even if it appears that way. Jack will rise out of the pool and make some joke and tuck a towel around his waist so people won't notice his belly, and the stunt people would be congratulated for having fooled us again. So yes, the thought went through my mind, maybe something's really the matter with Jack, but I pushed it out, telling myself Jack likes to kid around, and this is one of the things I don't like about him. I get jealous of him. A woman kidding around just isn't as much fun. But the joke is going on a long time, and I'm thinking, well, maybe it's not a joke, and then I'm almost sure it's not a joke, but I'm putting off the moment I do something about it because I want time to stop. Though I don't like Jack, I don't like tragedy either. Or rather, though it's a terrible thing to say, of course I like tragedy. Terrible things are exciting. They make the adrenaline flow, mark out special moments from our lives. But I like it on my own time, when it's convenient for me, when I'm in the mood for it, when I'm not thinking later about that might happen with the Haitian, or the dinner party Brian's taking me next week with the billionaire I'm hoping to do an interview with. No, though I've looked forward with anticipation, as well as dread, to war and other horrors, though there's nothing much sexier than a tank going across a desert with a grimy helmeted soldier sitting on top, though tornadoes and hurricanes and floods fill me with as much adrenalized excitement as the next person, though perhaps nothing was ever more beautiful than those towers melting. For once, I was not in the mood for tragedy. I wanted the evening and the week to progress to their expected conclusion, with the Haitian in my bed whispering soft, incomprehensible words and the billionaire granting me access. Everything to go on calmly and predictably without anything much out of the ordinary, save perhaps a repeat with the Haitian. You could say I was content or even happy, and this is not a usual state for me. It felt almost like grace. But Jack is not cooperating, Brian is not cooperating, Philip is not cooperating, Robin is not cooperating, Stephen is not cooperating, and I am not cooperating. The 30 and 40 and 50-year-olds and 20-somethings are not cooperating, the weather's not cooperating, and all the moments of everyone's lives that add up to this moment are not cooperating. We are all at some bizarre confluence of place and time and alcohol consumption, where things that would turn out fine 999,000 times out of a million, for some reason this night will not. That one of the little acts or tricks or jokes that we engage in every day of our lives will, for once, end in tragedy rather than indifference or farce. I say tragedy, not accident, because although, of course, it's an accident, it's still an outcome of all that Jack, but even more Brian, is. For none of this would have happened, at least in this particular way, at this particular time, had Brian not inherited money, had he not met Philip, had he not made certain decisions involving house buying and pool building and decking and so on, had he not eaten and drunk precisely what he did and thought what he thought and said what he said this night and all day too. Nothing in life exists in a vacuum, so Brian's responsible, Philip's responsible, the contractor and the landscaper who put the stone around the pool are responsible. because it is reasonable to suppose that Brian, having started to trip, tried to convert that gesture into something intentional and humorous by pushing me, then Philip, and finally Jack into the pool. As when you do a jerky dance step, you repeat it a few times to pretend that those jerky movements were in fact what you intended. And of course, Brian would not have tried to convert something accidental into something humorous and intentional. We're not all these super hip people standing by the side of the pool watching him and Jack. People would not have been there that day had the founders of the country not signed a certain piece of paper on July 4th. And in a way, everyone at the party is responsible, too, for being the kind of super hip and successful individual in front of whom one must act in a certain way, with a kind of cool that's a mixture of elegance and indifference. And one can go higher up the food chain, too, to capitalism and greed and desire, the molecules of our brains and bodies, et cetera, et cetera. And it is not, as Richard Feynman says, time does not move backward as well as forward, for if it could, we would rewind the path of molecules and dark matter and go back to the moment before the change that will affect not just Jack's life, but Brian's life and Philip's life and my life and everything we held dear about this part of our lives. If we could go back, we would, but we can't. The tragedy is unfolding. In a minute, it will all be over. The tape can't be rewound. And it's all a mistake, because up to the last moment when they had their fight, Jack was supposed to go to Connecticut with his new boyfriend, the one I hadn't met yet. Brian said instead of waiting around and being miserable, the best thing to do was leave town without him. So Jack went to Long Island instead, and surely if he'd gone to Connecticut or if the new boyfriend had come to Long Island, none of this would have happened. Nothing happens in the universe without it changing everything else. The world is like a giant spider web vibrating to the tiniest of ant footsteps, a trampoline in which every bounce augments or diminishes or cancels out other bounces, an equation so complicated no computer can solve them. We're all entangled particles whose every breath ripples across the entire universe. Yet we pretend we're singular and individual, that we won't bounce off the trampoline and break our necks against the edge. That while swimming parallel to the seawall when the tide is rushing in, we won't be knocked against the rocks and drowned. How we ever decide anything in a world where even the choice of which restaurant to go to brings up possibilities of bacteria and viruses and prions, streets in which men carry guns and traffic lights, buildings from which fall stones that cross your head. But staying inside doesn't help either. Howard Hughes, for all his money. Brian sees something. He jumps in the pool and turns Jack over on his back. Jack coughs, takes a breath, and then in a strange voice, I hear him say, I can't move my legs, and then I can't move my arms. Thank you.